az álom zolim herum, az álom zolim zeyn, ich leib in zinginken. Schöne noch und besser wie gewinn.
We're back with Bathrobe Spear Roberts Broadsides. That's Mark Levy's Yiddish side there. I think that's, I was going to skip that one for those of you who are not conversant in that language, but got to hear it anyway. If anybody out there has been recording this show, by the way, my own technology is screwed up, and I haven't gotten a tape of the first 45 minutes. And if you've got a tape and you want to share it with me, give me a call at 423-4833, which is my phone number, not the station's number. The station doesn't really have a phone. But if you want to get on the air, if you've got stuff you want to say, if you want to get kind of tuned in and get others to tune in to you, this is Free Radio, 89.3 FM in Santa Cruz. And we are open to those who want to come on the air and speak their piece. So give a call to me at 423-4833. If you're interested in going on the air, if you happen to be recording this show, want to share your tape with me, or if you have any comments about this show you think might be of interest to me, or critical comments that you think I might disagree with, but that the audience has a right to hear. So, what do we got next here? Well, I've been doing some reading from a history book called Radicalism in America by Sidney Lenz. He kind of has an alternate history about background to America, how things started in the colonies. We're talking about European America, of course, but still of interest to some of us, particularly since it gives us an alternate view of what may have happened, or what did happen back there that was not mentioned by the history books we read as kids and were forced to regurgitate in classrooms. So here's a little from Sidney Lenz's Radicalism in America, Colonial Rebels, Chapter 2. In this galaxy of poverty and wealth, it was not the British overseas who first gave offense to would-be radicals, but the native despots, in particular, the Puritans. The Puritan way of life, whatever its cultural virtues, was a deceitful and hypocritical one. The men of the Bible Commonwealth did not shrink from mass killings of Pequot and Narragansett Indians, the capture and shipment of Indians to Barbados as slaves, or the swindling of their lands. Their obsession with sin was as remarkable as it was narrow-minded. Men were whipped for failing to attend church, and lovers put on trial for sitting together on the Sabbath. A ship captain who kissed his wife on the street after returning from a long voyage was fined. To disagree with the Puritan theocracy was the ultimate in crimes. Thus, John Winthrop, one of the colony's governors, reports that the servant, Philip Ratliff, quote, was censured to be whipped, lose his ears, and be banished from the plantation because he used, quote, most foul, scandalous invectives against our churches and government. Quakers and Baptists were whipped, imprisoned, branded on their bodies, at times even hanged for their nonconformist views. Some were banished from the colony, 14 in 1630 alone. It was against this background that a young preacher, Roger Williams, arrived in Boston in 1631. Son of a merchant tailor, seemingly an orthodox Puritan in the old country, Williams became the implacable enemy of the theocratic order and the foremost revolutionary of his time. His enemies called him a firebrand. His friends said he was divinely mad. He was probably a little of both. Shocked by Puritan practices, Williams went to live with the Pilgrims in Plymouth for a while, but returned in 1634 to wage a campaign of denunciation against the oligarchy, which led to his banishment. He castigated the bloody doctrine of persecution for the cause of conscience. He called the Puritan clergy false hirelings, their churches ulcered and gangrened, their members unregenerates. More than theological differences were involved in such charges. If the state could ostracize a man for his religious views and deprive him of the right to vote, He was thereby hampered in earning a living and in all other matters. Characteristically, Williams was the first man to insist the land belonged to the Indians, not to the white men, and that the king's patent gave the colonists no right to seize that land or pay a dishonest price for it. The king was, for him, an alien, and with no more authority to give away other people's property than anybody else. Mild as this may sound to cosmopolitan ears 3.5 centuries later, it was a shocking concept then. No other Englishman had ever stated such heresies. Indeed, Williams antedated Voltaire and Rousseau in expressing such views by a full century. At issue between Williams and the Puritans was the right of the individual as against the theocratic state. He called for repeal of all laws for compulsory church attendance as well as religious qualifications for voting. He questioned the magistrate's right to punish anyone for breaching the Sabbath. In the opinion of Puritan church leaders, such beliefs were bound to lead to heresy, apostasy, or tyranny, and had to be punished. On October 1635, the rebel preacher was tried by the general court and ordered to depart out of this jurisdiction within 6 weeks. Illness prevented the enforcement of this edict until the following spring, but meantime, Williams continued his infamies. The Puritans decided, therefore, to ship him back to England, where he would unquestionably be tried for treason, for denying the king's title to American land, and at best, would have both his ears cut off, and at worst, face hanging. Warned of this threat, Williams and 5 friends fled to the wilderness, where they lived in severe winter cold for 14 weeks. Ultimately, they were given refuge by the Narragansett Indians, from whom Williams purchased a piece of land on which he established the town of Providence, now Providence, Rhode Island. In accordance with his principles, he paid fair value to the Indians. That summer, he was joined by other malcontents from the Bay Colony. 2 years later, Anne Hutchinson, another religious rebel, banished for sedition and contempt, founded Portsmouth. The town of Newport came into being in 1639, and the 3 centers merged into what was eventually formalized as the colony of Rhode Island. Rhode Island, dubbed Rogues Island, threatened with invasion by Massachusetts, was the most democratic society of its time. Religious freedom, called voluntarism by Williams, was absolute. Not only Quakers and Anabaptists fled there for safety, but Jews and, quote, witches. The form of government was democratical, that is to say, a government held by the free and voluntary consent of all or the greater part of the free inhabitants. Officers were elected annually and subject to removal. Imprisonment for debt, one of the evils that was to plague America into the 19th century, was abolished, and the penal code was generally revamped in the direction of humane treatment. Relations with the Indian remained friendly and scrupulously fair. The plight of the white slave was greatly mitigated, his period of servitude reduced. For his time, Roger Williams was as radical a figure as Eugene V. Debs 2 centuries later. Though he did not abolish private property as other religious leftists did, and he failed to grant full equality to women, he was in the 17th century the embodiment of what was later to become known as the American ideal, religious liberty, individualism, political freedom. In the wide expanse, with communications as poor as they were in early America, it is understandable that Williams' philosophy did not become universal. If only it had microwave radio. Even so, there were among his contemporaries not a few who leaned in the same direction. There was the Reverend Thomas Hooker, who established Connecticut on almost similar lines. The foundation of authority, said Hooker, is laid in the free consent of the people. There were Anne Hutchinson, John Wheelwright, William Coddington, Samuel Gorton. These were the Quakers who believed that, quote, all men are Christ's. I don't know what they said about the women, but one would hope, probably hope in vain, and who practiced the doctrine of nonviolence toward others. There were the Hutterites, the Moravians, the Mennonites, who established communistic colonies. There were the Anabaptists, who condemned the ecclesiastical state, and others. Historians may dispute how much influence such forces exerted on the evolution of the United States, but it is clear that whether their impact was small or large, they helped prevent the reformation in America of the rigidly closed society that was Europe. And there's a lot more here. In fact, I'll read a little more. Part 3. The religious radicals, important as they were in American annals, were essentially doctrinaires whose actions fitted preconceived ideas. Though their preachings of equality threatened the dominant classes, the economic portent of their philosophy was obscured by religious phraseology. This was not the case with the lay rebels who occupied the center of the stage in ensuing decades. For them, freedom of conscience was important, but subordinate to more mundane demands. Contrary to popular image, there was hardly a decade of the colonial period, sometimes hardly a year, without uprisings and insurgencies. The most dramatic revolt of the 17th century was Bacon's Rebellion in 1676. Without exaggeration, writes V.F. Calverton, it was the beginning of the struggle that was to dominate the history of this country. It was the first revolt of the common people, small farmers, impoverished freemen, even some white indentures, against the authority of a royal governor and his privileged class. It came within an inch of permanently toppling the regime of Sir William Barclay, and perhaps, if Bacon had not died, it would have led to a revolt against British rule itself. Nathaniel Bacon, young man of 28, distantly related to the British philosopher Francis Bacon, had arrived in Virginia not long after being graduated from Cambridge. He was a tall man, slender, black-haired, reticent, and melancholy. He had the characteristics of one who immediately excited either loyal friendship or unbounded hostility. He spoke in pithy phrases with little subtlety. He lacked the philosophical ability of a Jefferson, and he was clearly no diplomat or politician. He cannot be called a utopian, but he had an unremitting faith in the common person, whom he was willing to lead not only against the governor, but the king himself. That was all the more remarkable because Bacon was a man of the upper class. Rich, fashionably married, he built a grand mansion along the James River, which he called his castle. But though he was an aristocrat by birth, he was a friend of the underdog by disposition. What he saw in the colony disturbed him. Quote, "The poverty of the country is such that all the power and sway is got into the hands of the rich, who by extortionist advantages, having the common people in their debt, have always curbed and oppressed them in all their manner of ways." In a famous exchange with Barclay, Bacon expounded a philosophy which, while not erudite, was weighted on the side of the common man. In simple and blunt terms, he condemned the persons who backed the king against the people. He rebuked the officials who exploited the great mass and denounced the aristocratic elements who had gained vast estates through favoritism and fraud. He concluded categorically that it was his mission to change all this by force if necessary. The trouble in the backwoods of Virginia was both economic and political. It began with the Navigation Acts of 1660, which gave Britain a monopoly over the rich tobacco crop. In the following years, the price of tobacco fell from 3 pence a pound to a half penny. But when the farmers tried to sell their tobacco to other colonies instead of to Britain, a tax of 1 penny per pound was levied on such trade, making it prohibitive. Simultaneously, British merchants completed the squeeze by raising the price of finished goods. As the farmers went into debt, they were harried further by exorbitant interest rates. And if these man-made woes were not enough, they had to contend with a hurricane in 1667 that left thousands homeless and destroyed much of the crop, and an epidemic in 1672-73 which killed off half the cattle. During all this travail, a small clique around Governor Barclay formed a powerful political machine. The governor and his cronies grabbed the choicest lands, exempted themselves from taxation, held the best public jobs, and lived in a luxury comparable to that of the aristocrats in London. Much of their wealth came from a lucrative trade with the Indians, with whom they exchanged trinkets, liquor, and firearms for fur. From 1660 to 1674, Barclay permitted no elections for the House of Burgesses, that is to say, like the state legislature, which became a rubber stamp for his depredations. Sheriffs appointed by Barclay levied fees as they pleased. New taxes were imposed with painful regularity for projects such as the building of forts for defense against Indians, which were seldom completed. An act of 1670 took away the right to vote from all those who did not own land. Only a spark, therefore, was needed for rebellion. It came as a result of relations with the Indians. Trouble on this front was as old as the colony, since the Virginians, by their own admission, as noted in an act passed in 1662, were guilty of violent intrusions into lands they had agreed were to remain Indian. Understandably, the Indians initiated attacks and reprisal. The sporadic warfare made farming difficult, and in some cases impossible. Without physical security, the backwoods farmer was in serious trouble. But when he applied to Barclay for defense, he was met with procrastination and inactivity. The governor, though he was not a friend of the red man per se, found it useful to retain the western border of the colony as close to the seaboard as possible. Thus, he could maintain easier control over his constituents while keeping the cost of furs, which he and his friends bought from the Indians, as cheap as possible. He did not want to push the Indian further west. In the face of Barclay's determination, therefore, Bacon, elected to the House of Burgesses by this time, decided to take matters into his own hands. His expedition against the Indian achieved security, and in the process brought matters to a head with Barclay as well. The governor declared Bacon a rebel, but when he marched to Jamestown at the head of more than 500 armed rebels on June 23, 1676, he was given a hero's welcome and assumed control of the colony. In the brief interval that Bacon ruled, he restored a host of popular prerogatives. Restrictions on the right of free men to vote for the burgesses were abolished. Democracy was restored to the church by granting free citizens the right to elect the vestries. Sheriffs in the future were to be chosen for 1 year only. The army was purged of many aristocratic privileges and soldiers permitted to select their own officers. Taxes were levied on the families of government ministers who had previously been exempt. Nor did he stop there. Evidence indicates that Bacon became fascinated with the dream of a broader colonial uprising. He conferred with John Culpepper, who later guided a similar revolt in Albemarle, which was North Carolina, what they called it then, and he foresaw a pact between Virginia, Albemarle, and Maryland to gain independence from British rule. In this, if the fragmentary material on the subject is conclusive, he anticipated Patrick Henry and Samuel Adams by a full century. The rebellion, however, could not be sustained. On September 18th, Bacon was able to drive Barclay and 600 poorly armed men out of the capital, but exactly 1 month later, he died suddenly of a fever. Without his leadership, the insurgency collapsed. Barclay came back to power, and the British sent 1,000 troops to, quote, restore order. 37 of Bacon's followers were executed. One of them, Anthony Arnold, gave the royal judges a political exposition that represented the general viewpoint of the Baconians. Kings, he said, have no rights but what they got by conquest and the sword, and he who can by the force of the sword deprive them thereof has as good and just a title to them as the king himself. If the king should deny to me right, I would think no more of it to sheathe my sword in his heart or bowels than that of my mortal enemy. And that is Bacon's Rebellion. That is Radicalism in America by Sidney Lenz. And you're listening to Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides on Free Radio, 89.3 FM in Santa Cruz. Comments about this reading? Do you want to get on the air? General thoughts? Reactions to this show? Just give me a call at 423-HUFF. It's not a hotline into the station, but it is a line that I will call you back from later, and we can talk more. Now a little bit more of Mark Levy. As soon as I can get this tape queued up, that is. Will be coming on. That's Mark Levy's Heroes, Sheroes. He's got some great political songs. And here's one of them coming down the pike.
There's a new wind blowing east to west, blowing into Warsaw, Prague and Budapest. A fresh breeze blowing from Moscow to Berlin. Open. let it in. World War II has ended, the Nazis have surrendered, the armies of the German Reich are beaten back at last. A continent in ruin was by the Allies hewn, and Germany divided, so to not repeat the past. But there's a new wind blowing, blowing east to west, blowing into Warsaw, Prague and Bucharest. A fresh breeze blowing from Moscow to Berlin. Open up the wall and let it in. Cold War II is ending, the old guard are descending, they turn to see the people rising up, demanding change. From a Europe split at Yalta, to a summer talk at Malta, Slav and Magyar, Czech and German step into the age of a new wind blowing, blowing east to west, blowing into Warsaw, Prague and Budapest. A fresh breeze blowing from Moscow to Berlin. Open up the wall and let it in. Are filled with voices as East Berlin rejoices. West Berliners welcome in their neighbors from the east. Dancing across the border, changing the old order. The wall that held the people could not hold back their ideas of a new.
From his Heroes, Sheroes album. Mark is a man who's supported with his own guitar and his own butt the right of poor people, homeless people, everybody to sit down on the sidewalk in the demonstrations that happened last year. The right of people, all of us, to use public spaces no matter what our poverty level, no matter what our fashion statement, no matter what quality of dress we have or income level we have. Mark was there playing his guitar. He actually composed a song talking about the right of people to eat free food. There was a woman who was sent to jail in 1989. Actually, all of us went to jail. Many of us went to jail one time or another, but she spent 2.5 weeks in jail for 3 weeks in jail, a little more than 3 weeks, for serving food at the town clock. Marty Wormhout was then mayor and authorized the raids on the town clock that where cops in riot gear came and hauled away people both eating and serving soup. That was a major scandal. It actually was reported in papers as far away as Bombay. That's Mark Levy, good man, good singer. And Marty Wormhout's name kind of came up for me again this morning. I received a call from Marty's aide, Andy Schifrin. Marty is now supervisor. And controversy has kind of arisen around the use of the Bookshop Santa Cruz. Some of you may know Bookshop Santa Cruz is a large bookshop downtown owned and run by Neil Coonerty, who is a local guy, also has been mayor. He was a city council member, largely responsible for leading the cry against homeless activists, making sure that the downtown ordinances were passed, and then barring activists from his store, barred me and at least a dozen other people. People actually who had been friendly with him, he became completely irrational in his dealings with people around the issues of the downtown ordinance. I guess he took it very personally. Somebody threw a rock through his window. He used that as a pretext to bar me because I had gone downtown and pointed out the different businesses to a group of visiting homeless activists, pointed out who were the leaders in the campaign to remove rights from poor people downtown, make it criminal for them to do things like ask for a dime in a peaceful way, to criminalize begging, for example. But anyway, Marty Wormhout holds her supervisors' orientation meetings in the Bookshop Santa Cruz every Monday before a supervisor's meeting. She does this at 5 o'clock, and the problem that has arisen is that she is a public official, and presumably this meeting should be open to the public. She kind of advises people as to what's going to be on the agenda, takes their suggestions, and so forth. But of course, Neil Coonerty refuses to let many of us into the bookshop, even for the purpose of attending this meeting. So I've been asking for weeks that this meeting either be moved or that she prevail upon Neil Coonerty to relax his ban for at least the 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock on Mondays before the supervisor's meeting when she holds her powwow there. Well, she says she's talked to him, but he won't do it, and they're looking for another place. And the latest word was today that she's agreed to do it, but only starting in August, because they want to have time to find a place. And to her credit, it should also be said, she has agreed to meet with people who want to talk to her at her office independently of this meeting at the Bookshop Santa Cruz. So there is that. But for those of us who can't go to these meetings, it's just another instance of cronyism, just straight abuse of homeless activists who are discriminated against, and obliviousness to sort of fundamental fairness in public policy, that these matters are not immediately dealt with. I mean, if she were meeting in a place that suddenly had been revealed that blacks were not being let in there, she would not wait until August or say, we're having a separate meeting for black people, you know, in my office. I mean, that wouldn't go over too well, and she couldn't possibly do that. But she holds homeless activists in so low esteem, they are just not one of her number one priorities, that, you know, oh gee, well, you have to wait 3 months to participate, to have your political rights acknowledged. No, that's fine. So I wrote her a letter, and I also wrote a letter to the Sentinel, which I'm going to read you, because you'll probably never read it in the Sentinel. They have a habit of losing my letters or not printing them. Occasionally they do. In fact, I got to say, the last letter I wrote them was printed in its entirety, even mentioning my boycott of the Bookshop Santa Cruz, which I, by the way, am still doing. You might say, well, if I'm boycotting the Bookshop Santa Cruz, then isn't it fair that Neil ban us from the bookshop? And the answer is no, not particularly not if public meetings are happening there. It's inappropriate to ban anybody from a public meeting unless they're engaging in actually disruptive behavior, and that's something else. So I wrote this letter to Marty Wormhout, and this is how it goes. Thank you for your willingness to speak to Neil Coonerty about assuring free public access to your Monday afternoon agenda meetings. I appreciate your efforts to make sure that all of us have an opportunity to attend these sessions, though I rarely do, I admit. As you may be aware, some 10 to 20 local people have been barred from the Bookshop Santa Cruz because of Coonerty's presumptions of their association with protest against the downtown ordinances and or the boycott of the bookshop. Some of those people were actually just individuals who came to John Hamilton's homeless table, whom Neil associated with us, who were interested spectators. Because my direct contacts with Neil were unproductive in the past, I have asked Frank Kaler, owner of the nearby Game-A-Lot toy store, to deliver a letter to Neil and speak to him about access to the bookshop during your meetings. Many months of meetings have been closed to activists because of the location of the agenda discussions. This matter was brought to your attention numerous meetings ago. I understand from Andy that Neil has refused to change his decision, at least regarding me. I appreciate your willingness to hold separate but equal meeting with the excluded group in your office, but feel that is not really fair, comfortable, or appropriate. Neil may have the right to exclude us from his private property, though the State UNRRA Civil Rights Act raises questions about excluding people from private property normally open to the public. Still, I'm sure you, as a more neutral party and a public official, want your meetings publicly accessible to all. I feel particularly incensed that the new law Coonerty authored, barring the wrong sort of musicians and political tablers, but it's particularly offensive for him to bar the public from a public meeting. Though it may involve some inconvenience, moving your meeting from the bookshop, I think it's the only just solution at the moment, so forth and so on. Feel free to call me, and so forth. So that may not have been so terribly exciting to read, since I'm essentially repeating what I told you before. But there is an issue there, and if you're a patron of the bookshop, and when I call for a boycott, what I mean by a boycott is don't just not go in the bookstore. Go in the bookstore and tell the management you'd like to patronize the bookstore, but because of their policies against homeless activists, because of their support of the downtown ordinances that criminalize and people on the streets and privatize the sidewalks, you can't, and you'd like to see that policy change. That's the kind of boycott I envisage myself, although they may tell you you're banned too. You never can tell. Neil had a letter to the paper recently, in which he said he attacked the radio station KSCO for allowing, he attacked the content of what Dave Allen said on the air. Dave Allen is a right-wing nut, with all apologies to Dave, who cuts off his callers and calls them fags and lesbians and commies, and that's the kind of language he uses about his political opponents. That's true. I believe some of the folks are, I call my political opponents here clowns, and I certainly think some of them are fascist-minded, but I don't think I would ever call the city council fascists per se. I mean, I don't, well, maybe I would. I don't know. Anyway, Coonerty didn't like the language that was being used over radio station KSCO, and again, along with Clinton's call for against quote, so-called hate radio, Coonerty suggested that the KSCO station was broadcasting hate and bigotry, but that the real solution to them was not to censor them, but to just shun them, just don't listen to them, which I tend to agree with, actually. I agree with Neil on this issue, but it's kind of ironic because Neil has taken a different perspective with respect to activists whom he disagrees with. He doesn't shun us. He bars us or censors us in the sense that he denies us the same rights that everybody else has in going to his bookstore. And he also, in this situation, is barring us access to public meetings. So here's the letter I wrote to the Sentinel on this issue. Neil Coonerty says he opposes censorship in talk radio. He tells us to shun, not to ban, those who peddle hate. Good advice. But does he follow it himself? Last year, as council member, he sponsored the Sit on the Sidewalk, Go to Jail law, which provoked public beatings and a near riot last May 11. I and other homeless activists then asked people to boycott, I shun, his bookshop Santa Cruz in protest. Neil's response was to ban, i.e. censor us, from entering his business on threat of arrest. So while we took to heart Neil's shun, don't ban political opponents rule with our boycott, he locked us out with his ban. For months, we could not attend Supervisor Marty Wormhout's supposedly public Monday meetings in Neil's bookshop, where she outlines and discusses the Tuesday agenda of the Board of Supes. KSCO owner Michael Zwirling and Coonerty share more than they know. Zwirling's talk show hosts Dave Allen and John Sandich both censor incoming calls. Sandich stopped me even before I got on the air. So both men believe in free speech, for those rich enough to own a bookshop or a radio station, that is. And that's my letter to the Sentinel, with which I include this P.S. Neil's letter, which you printed on two successive days, runs well over 280 words. Have you changed your policy for all of us, or is the sacred 200-word limit waived for selected downtown merchants? You'll find if you write a letter to the Santa Cruz County Sentinel, your letter will be returned, or mine has, letters from friends of mine, actually, since my letters I usually make shorter because I know about this. If it's under 200 words, they send it back. Unless you're Neil Coonerty, apparently, in which case they'll print it 2 days in a row, which is what they did last week. They printed it the second time, they said, because it was somewhat garbled the first time, but it was still over 280 words on both occasions. Well, anyway, there's a radio station you can speak out on. You don't have to write the newspaper. Well, you can do that, too. You don't have to wait until city council ignores you. You can talk to the community directly, and you can talk to them on radio station 89.3 FM, which is what you're listening to right now. Bathrobe Spear Robert's Broadsides, and I am Bathrobe Spear Robert, without my bathrobe at the moment, but still the same guy. If you're interested in commenting on this show, or if you want to get on the air and you want more information, I can give you my number, which is not the radio station's number. We don't really have a number yet. Send your dollars and cards and letters. But you can get word to the station through me. And my number is 423-HUFF, or 423-4833. 423-4833 to reach Santa Cruz Free Radio, 89.3 FM. And if you want to drop a line to the station, there is a post office box you can do it at. It's Post Office Box 7652, 95061, Santa Cruz, California. So that is an option for you. Earlier on the show, looks like I screwed up here. I pointed out that there's going to be a Community Awareness Day coming on May 20th. Well, that's true. That's Saturday. But that is next Saturday, actually. I said it was a week from Saturday. It isn't. It's next Saturday. Community Awareness Day, Loudon Nelson Center Park, downtown Santa Cruz, all day, starting around 10:30, going to 6:30. All kinds of groups, Food Not Bombs, IWW, Women's Crisis Support, Homeless Garden Project, Battered Women's Support, HUFF, Progressive Labor, Green Party, you name it, they're going to be there. You be there. Talking about Proposition 187, homelessness, revolution in the 90s, political prisoner, Mahmoud Abu-Jabal, U.S. imperialism, poverty, hey, you talk about it, we'll hear about it, I guess, if you go there. If you're interested in information, call 423-4981. On the court scene, as I also mentioned earlier, Lighthouse Linda LeMaster, a local activist with Welfare Parent Support Group, Housing Now. She's a member of the Women's Commission on the Prevention of Violence to Women. She's on the board of directors of the Westside Health Center. I'm not sure if I have that right. She's a longtime fighter for poverty rights, and nothing can stop her. She's probably facing jail tomorrow in the Kangaroo Court of referee John Meatgrinder Mulligan. Now, Meatgrinder Mulligan is a local traffic referee, or judge, as he styles himself in his black robes, who we have been monitoring for years, those of us in HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, who've been following trials in his court, usually trials of homeless people for camping, where he says to the police officer, tell us the facts of the case, indicating how unbiased he is. Anyway, Mulligan has told Linda LeMaster, activist Linda LeMaster, that she, in a case involving a fine on an insurance ticket, where she didn't have adequate insurance in her car, she will not be able to work off the ticket. Instead, she's going to have to either go to jail or pay the money. She may be going to jail. That's going to happen tomorrow, Tuesday, May 16th at 1:30 in the basement of the county building, Mulligan's Traffic Court, right next to the traffic windows. So any of you who are concerned about poverty issues and would like to see an example of what happens if you're poor in Santa Cruz and the courts don't like you, check that out. That's 1:30 tomorrow. Then at 10 o'clock on Friday, that's Friday, May 19th, three other scallywags are going to be in court, and they're going to be on trial. They will be on trial for sleeping. And actually, they weren't even asleep. They'll be in trial for lying down with blankets. And that is myself, Robert Norris, Skidmark Bob Duran of the band Just Kidding, and Main Street Mark Peterson, who's also a local activist. Three of us were arrested, along actually with three others, for violating the camping ban. We were having a speak out at the Bookshop Santa Cruz last November on issues of the anti-poor laws, that Neil Coonerty and others successfully passed last year at City Council, which is still law, by the way. And at 11:01, 1 minute after it became illegal to be wrapped up in blankets under the sleeping ban, they took us all to jail. And now we're facing a trial in the courtroom of Judge Robert Artichoke Hart Attic. And come in, FCC. If that's the FCC, they're breaking down our doors. No, I'm just kidding, folks. This trial of me, Bob Duran, and Mark Peterson will be happening Friday at 10 in Department 2. So if you're interested in observing a real snoozy activities in court, what happens to three ne'er-do-wells who are going to one of the iciest judges in town? Attic was the judge who sentenced Sandra Loringer to jail for serving food to the homeless back in 1989. It was quite a notorious action on his part. She refused probation, but he could have done better, and I think he knows it now. So anyway, those are several things coming up. Tomorrow, Linda LeMaster, 1:30 in Mulligan's Court in the basement of the county building. Friday, 10 o'clock, Attic's Court, Department 2, the camping trial of the three homeless activists from the Speak Out at the Bookshop Santa Cruz last November. The day after, Saturday, all day, Loudoun Nelson Center, Community Awareness Day. And probably lots of other things happening, but I got to find them before I can tell you about them. So you get to hear a little bit more of Mark Levy while I secure my notes. And here comes Mark.
Into the dark, nightmare. twilight in Munich, 1943.